Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Romesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello, everybody. This is The Ruck from The Times and The Sunday Times. Thanks a million again for joining us. Season still steaming on. I'm Stephen Jones, and alongside me in the studio is the great Alan Dimmock from Rugby World. And down the line, in more ways than one, is Stuart Barnes.
Very Dylan-esque, I like it.
Exactly. Now, just to point of view, if anyone wants to book Stuart for evenings, etc., he won't be available on Thursdays next season. With Arsenal almost certainly being in the minor European competition. So if anyone wants me, don't forget, I won't be free on Wednesdays when Spurs are playing in the main Champions Cup. Chaps, Al, your weekend, any highlights, lowlights, anything you want to reveal?
It's interesting that Stuart said Dylan-esque, because I'm sure we'll leave some blood on the tracks when we're talking about a couple of these European games. And some there were some fantastic moments that we can dug into, but there were also some proper stinkers.
Stuart, we sent you on a mission really to save the north of England's rugby, but I think it needs a bit of saving, doesn't it?
The nosebleed was pretty bad when I got north of Stoke, but I recovered. I found my way to the ground without any problem. It was a stinking match, but, you know, let's not forget, we've all seen our fair share of horrendous games. What really upset me, Steve, was this was the first leg of a round of 16 European ties, biggest tournament in this hemisphere, apparently, and 4,600 or something turned up to watch it. And, you know, I wrote in the paper today, rugby's about two things. It's about the excitement and the quality and the intensity of the game, but it's also about atmosphere. And there was no atmosphere. And I just think you get people talking about Ealing, their ground's only takes 5,000 people. They can't come up. But if you've got a ground that can hold between 10 and 11,000, but you always get 5,000, where does that leave the...
I totally agree. And that's obviously, these are obviously thoughts we're going to continue and expand on now. We're going to go look back on the last 16 first legs in the European Championship Cup. We're also round up, or we'll be looking at the latest in the Women's Six Nations. And here and now, let's wish a complete recovery for Abby Dow, who had a nasty leg injury. We'll be hearing from Will Kelleher. We sent our junior journalist away on the European Cup trail. Sadly, he was not allowed to. He's not old enough to drink in any establishments over there, but that doesn't mean he can't report back to us. We'll also have our God and Goddess of the Week. But first, let's get into the European action. Let's just make an overall point, chaps, and I'd be interested in your views. In my opinion, and I've thought this for some time, I'm not saying the Champions Cup is now worthless or it's not the LV Cup or anything like that, but it has gone down in the affections of people, and it doesn't have, for me, quite the same ringing importance as it did. I mean, Exeter's got a great new ground, which wasn't full for Munster. It would have been, I think, for a championship game, for a premiership game. Stuart, you know, there was the token attendance really at Sale. Is it, I know there are other issues, but first of all, Al, is it the tournament itself which is wavering slightly and looking for its new self?
I think it depends on which clubs are involved. I mean, we've got to the situation in this tournament this year where some teams have stumbled into the knockout rounds, and you can talk about the format of that and how that's been allowed to happen. It's interesting. I was hearing dispatches a couple of days ago that Montpellier only now have decided, actually, we've got a chance of taking a big bit of silverware here, so we'll redouble our efforts to try and win this famous tournament. Apparently, there was a missive from on high from their all-seeing leader and financier that's what they wanted to do. And there'll be clubs that just really, this is potentially a nuisance. I was seeing some dispatches. I was reading Bernard Jackman at the weekend saying, it's great that Connacht were putting their lot in to try and beat Leinster, their famous foe. A really close match, eatsy peeksy for a lot of it. Could have got a result had it not been for going to offer 20 minutes rather than 10 minutes for one of the players, Jameson Gibson-Park. But I saw Bernard Jackman saying maybe they shouldn't have focused so much on this because they're not going to be in Europe proper next season from their league performances, and maybe they should do what a lot of French clubs have done down the years and focus more on their club competition. This should be the pinnacle, shouldn't it?
It should be. It should be the pinnacle, and always was, but I just don't think it is anymore. Stuart, no, there's no excuse for Sale, a Premiership club against Bristol, only bringing that number of people. Where do you stand on the status of the whole tournament, and what are your other theories regarding? We know what your other theories are regarding Sale because you wrote about it in the paper this morning. But just to expand on that a little.
Steve, I have quite a lot of sympathy with Europe here. I think they got a pounding by the pandemic like nothing else. The Premiership, when it had its problems, was able to drift the season months later. Europe had to find its way to fit in, and the way they did it damaged the reputation in the short term. You didn't have to qualify from the pools. We like our traditions. Everyone knows that it's the five pools go through and the best three runners up, and you have a sense of elitism. But Alan's point about Montpellier, suddenly, they lost 89-7 to Leinster. Suddenly, we got a chance. And you were looking at teams in the last 16 with 28-0 wins and 0-0 draws. So that whole prestige and the whole aura had fallen away, I think. And it's going to take some recapturing. Not this season, I don't think. I think this season, once you get to the last eight semis, it's Europe. So you still want to win it. But even Exeter's year when they won it, I didn't feel that was as Europe should be. And if an old and grey hack is thinking it's not the same, then you've got to understand that clubs and players and coaches will probably be thinking the same as well.
Understood. Stuart, just tell me another thing, though. There's no excuse for it for being quite as bad as yourself and Alan say it was at Sale. Sale have got some tremendous South African forwards and some very, very clever backs. Why can they never seem to stitch the two together? And why do they lack? Why are they lacking so much in rhythm?
I tell you what, the AJ McGinty is so much more important than people recognise at Sale. Without McGinty, they play Robert Dupree, who's bigger than most English international second rows at fly half, and they crash everything. They clatter. There's no awareness of space whatsoever. They become an unbelievably one-dimensional team. And it does ask a few questions at the moment of Alex Sanderson. He's got to find variety because at the moment, if they don't have McGinty, who's out injured, then Sale just become a very wooden team. And, you know, we're in an era that if it's obvious what you're going to do, even if you've got such a big pack and such a bulky midfield with Manu just running into brick walls, you know, this is an era when defence coaches have built brick walls that are pretty sturdy. And all Sale are doing are bashing and breaking their nose, running straight into them. It's very naive. And, you know, let's be honest, Bristol are not playing well. Bristol won that game, but they didn't win it because they were tactically brilliant. They won it because Sale were just so wooden and disappointing.
The thing is, well, yeah, I was going to jump in and say that it takes two to tango or two to fall in a tangle, I suppose, but this one is both sides were atrocious for this one, and I'm going to plagiarise myself here. I tweeted at the weekend, there have been Victoria era surgeries more clinical than this game because there were just so many errors and it was all compounded. We saw, Stuart's right, we saw South African World Cup winners, Olympic gold medalists go, and England international. We saw an England international scrum half break from a scrum and with not that much pressure on him throw a ball scudding into the ground and into touch. And that was the game in a nutshell. And there were 15 seconds of joy when Semi Radradra strike move from a scrum went through untouched and scored. That was it, really. There wasn't much to write home about. It was one of those that had you saying woof. You know, just to touch on, and the other thing as well is that match was the one that they selected to go on Channel 4. So people that potentially were watching their first ever game of rugby union on lunchtime, for, you know, free to air television, and they watched that spectacle or lack of, which is, yeah, it is where it is. And just finally to touch on the attendance and atmosphere thing, let's remember as well, this is the exact same time when England women were playing Wales this weekend and got a massive attendance, and there's so much goodwill around that, and it's just an interesting contrast to see that at the same time.
It is funny because now Sale are at this new new look stadium and with huge car parks and all that. It's funny because I can remember going to Sale at when they were playing at Stockport, which is one of the most miserable looking grounds you've ever seen, and they used to get 10,000 people there supporting them mightily up this big bank. But there we go, that's another story.
That's a great atmosphere. Really brilliant, Stockport was,
and the press box was good as well. There was 20 people sitting where you could only get supposed to get 5 people, but there we are. Let's just go through some of the talking points of the day, chaps. Clermont were at one stage a formidable opponent at home, probably still reasonable. Leicester's excellent season continuing.
Yeah, it feels like in the great stock exchange of rugby, these are two teams going in two different directions. Leicester's fortunes just keep rising and rising at the moment. Clermont, I've heard some sentiments from France that they're maybe a couple years out of date and that actually this is the end of an era for them. Great club, huge community, incredible presence, always flattered to deceive in Europe, but been one of the big boys for a long time. And they just got, like a boa constrictor, they just got strangled to death by Leicester, and their tactics just didn't allow Clermont to play massively, and Leicester were hugely clinical. And, you know, there are times where they just go, here, have that, you can have the ball, try and play this out. Clermont could make a couple breaks, didn't really kill it off, and then, oh my God, there's Tommy Rafael again. And lose the ball, and it was a real, it kind of felt like a pivotal performance from Leicester. It was a, you know, in years gone by, they've probably struggled a little bit in France, and this is one of those where they went, you know what, this is who we are, stake in the ground, we can see this off. And even if we've got a card and a player off for the last 20 minutes, doesn't matter, we're going to score a try that, that completely bamboozles you. It was really powerful stuff from Leicester.
And Stuart, Tigers, possibly or maybe almost certainly now the biggest hope for England trophy.
Yeah, I still wonder when they come up against the likes of Leinster, who can match their power, if they've got the experience. But I was very impressed with Leicester. I think there's a structure to what they do, and the understanding is very good. Whereas, we'll touch on it later, I was devastated by the lack of game management from Harlequins. Really awful in Montpellier. Leicester just got it right to the point when they were clear, and Clermont had dropped. Their spirits leaked quicker than Cameron Smith's in the Masters when he hit it in the water last night. Yet Freddie Stewart had the ball 20 metres out. They didn't go for the big play, another try. They put it into the corner because they knew 29-10, they had them on toast to go at home. Don't take risks. Don't do anything stupid. Control the match. And that's exactly what Leicester did. And Stewart, who, you know, what did Leicester do? Ford's high kicks were brilliant. Stewart's chases were fantastic. And then the skill level to finish off the basics was really good. And I would say that they don't use the backs that much, but when they pass through the back line, it's very slick and it's accurate and they understand what they're doing. And if they want to use their backs a bit more, they can. Very impressive. Although Clermont probably fielded a team who were more suited to playing in the European Champions Cup over 35 tournament, and that was an issue.
Well, the Dorian, Cami Lopez, is now moving on, Stuart, so that looks like the end of an era there. Lads, let me just ask you, when you're leading 34-0 in the game, as were Montpellier, we'll come on to Quinns in a minute, because Stuart's darlings weren't very good in that stage of the match. But 34-0, surely you can run the clock down to defend a 34-0 lead, Al. I mean, I know the game's got faster and it's got more difficult to slow it down, but 34-0, I'd say now Quinns narrowly are favourites to go through on the two legs.
Well, like, I'm glad they didn't completely strangle it to death, because if you're going to have two legs, you want the second leg to have a bit of intrigue for it, because we've got to have something to watch next weekend.
Yes.
And, you know, Montpellier just weren't to be denied. And, you know, even if Quinns do come back, and we can talk about how amazing it is that it's only a 14-point gap. It's still a 14-point gap. And Zach Mercer was really on one. He was clearly enjoying playing in that pack, and it's just good to see a familiar face thriving in what is a different scenario.
I'm more concerned not with what Montpellier did at 34-0, but I'm more interested in what Harlequins, last play of the game. Harlequins were 11 points down and they conceded a penalty which enabled Pollard to boot a penalty over and turn an 11-point deficit into 14. They were running around in the last minute, 5 yards from their own line. There was only one thing that could have happened there, which is Montpellier could have scored some form, which is what they did. It was half time of the game. It wasn't full time. And I haven't seen such bad game management. And, you know, Steve, I've complimented Marcus Smith again and again, and it's one bad game. But he had one of those absolute shockers. He overplayed it in the first half, and he just didn't do the things Harlequins needed him to do in the second half. And while you say they're favourites, I think had they been 11 points down, I think that would be the case. But 14, I just think that gives Montpellier that little bit of an extra chance. I thought it was a terrible last couple of minutes from Harlequins. They played some cracking rugby to get back there. And then they panicked. All they had to do is get the ball off and just say, look, we've taken a pounding, but we're only 11 behind. It's a little bit like Scheffler in the Masters. Take a bogey, but don't take a double bogey. Take your medicine and come back and win. Harlequins tried to play the wonder shot when all they had to do was get it on the fairway and take their bogey. It was naive in the extreme.
We think we've been joined by Butch Hammond. Well, let's. We've actually got a roving reporter on the spot at some of these games. Let's talk to someone who was there, Will Kelleher. Will, with the exuberance of youth, you covered three games on the weekend, three European games. A brilliant effort. First of all, what was it like on the road in the Champions Cup?
Yeah, it was great. We did the brief Saracens Friday night. We did Toulouse Ulster on Saturday, which I think was my favourite of the three. Mm. And then Montpellier Quins on Sunday. And you guys will know, our listeners might not know, but I was in the car with David Rogers, the famous Getty photographer, and so he put in a lot of miles, but it was brilliant actually. And Toulouse is a great city, and they played in the football ground, so there's a bit more whistling for Wayne Barnes. But I thought he had a great game, Barnsley.
He did. You did see one absolutely almost animal-like tackle in the. We won't dwell on the Saracens game, but the tackle on Ben Harris was one of the worst and clearly intentional offences of the season, surely.
Yeah, I mean, that was horrible, wasn't it? It was one of those stone-cold red cards you've ever seen. Although, that could have been trumped by a game I wasn't at, up in Paris, where Tolu Latu put in a horrendous tackle on Chouzanou, where the guy jumped up in the air and he just took his legs out from underneath him. And I was just looking, actually, and it was his eighth card of the season. Two red, six yellow.
Will, you're absolutely destroying my devil of the week here.
Okay, we'll pretend we haven't heard that. Will, just going to Toulouse Ulster. I mean, okay, 40 against 14 men, but still decent result for Ulster, and Toulouse on the brink now, because they now have to go to Belfast, which, whoever you are, is not a pretty sight, really.
Yeah, it was an amazing atmosphere, actually. And as I mentioned before, so much whistling and booing and jeering for Wayne Barnes. But he got the red card right, and he got the decision. Balakoun's hat-trick, where the whole of the Toulousain thought that he was offside, but he wasn't. Mm. He ran it in. He had an amazing game, defensively as well as in attack. And Hume, the centre, gave him a couple of nice passes. McCloskey set one up for him as well. But yeah, going back to the Kingspan, going back to Ravenhill, Belfast, that's going to be an epic game, I think. I think Toulouse are probably still back themselves, but that crowd's going to be absolutely jumping, aren't they, in the Northern Ireland?
Yes, just to remind you that Toulouse have got a six-point deficit to take to the stadium. So that's one, as Al says, it is important that for the spectacle, etc., that these games are still in the balance. That one certainly is. And we've given Stuart's very critical of Marcus Smith at fly half, Will, saying he didn't have one of his best games tactically. Also an odd game, because at Montpellier, surely 34 points to nil up is enough for anybody. But what was the why did the match keep changing its balance? And was Smith really off, as much as Stuart says?
He really was, to be honest. I don't think I've seen Smith play like that for a long time, actually. Maybe since the sort of bad days of the end of Paul Gustard. But his kicking was all over the place. It actually was, watching it from the stands, it looked a little bit like England in France, where he was sort of just looking around for guys. And it didn't help that Esterhazen got a yellow card and then went off for 10 minutes, because it just lost all their structure, because he straightened the line for him so well. But yeah, his kicks were off, and there was one particular pass in the 22 where he tried one of his pullbacks from the line, and it just went to no one. It just went on the floor. It was alarmingly bad for Quins. And Danny Kerr was chatting to us afterwards, and he was just saying, we thought we'd got rid of those sort of things that we do, but clearly not. But to be honest, I back Quins, I think, to actually go and beat them Montpellier at home. 14 points, they'll probably score a couple of tries early on, and then it'll just be 0-0 again. It was a good, totally mental game, that one. Mercer was amazing, I thought.
We haven't mentioned much of Zach Mercer, but clearly had an outstanding game, and he looked like yet another one of Eddie's desperate selections by shoving him over to France. Well, let me just ask you one more thing that the boys you've been talking about, and I brought up, really. I don't think that this tournament is as big, feels as big or as dramatic or as sort of world-ending as it once was. It certainly wasn't at Sale, nor at Exeter, nor other places. Did you think the intensity and of the actual tournament was as much as you expected?
Yeah, I mean, I actually wrote this for the Sunday Times and in the after watching the Toulouse-Ulster game, and maybe I got a bit carried away because I was there and it was a sunny day and it was all nice, but I just thought that was such a great classic European Cup game. And I know that Sale-Bristol was terrible and there were a couple of others that weren't brilliant, but that Leicester-Clermont result was amazing. I thought the Montpellier-Quinns game was fascinating, and actually I think the last 16 two-legged thing is adding a little bit, because you've still got these ties in the balance. Even there's a couple that are probably gone, like Leicester are not going to sacrifice 19 points, are they, next week? But loads of them are in the balance, and it keeps the drama going. I know it's not possibly quite the days of old Stuart and Miles Harrison doing the commentary on Sky all those years ago and those great games, but I thought I really enjoyed it, but maybe that's because I've had a nice
all those years ago. All those years ago.
It wasn't that long ago, honestly. It was just before conscription came in. Thanks a lot, Will Kelleher, our man on the spot. In fact, our man on three spots. And speak to you soon, Will.
See you later, guys. Enjoy the pod.
Just before we go on to lads to speak about the actual the system of the tournament and the structure, should say something about Exeter and Munster. You always expect Munster to come out and give it everything and more and be blisteringly involved and unoptimistic. And in fact, they were. Nor were they very good, though, actually. It was the first time I've seen one of the new laws which were brought in really affect the game. I think Exeter must have been over the Munster line probably six times and failed to ground the ball, therefore concede the ball to the dropout. Exeter will kick themselves black and blue that they weren't gone by half time. And Munster, fair play, were managed to come back, took advantage of two really poor sin binnings by that's pulled by the referee. So again, Exeter Munster becomes a great two leg game and plenty Steve, on it.
Steve, I watched that game after my sojourn in Sale Sunday morning, and I'd seen the score, and you think 13-8, and I thought it was riveting. I thought, considering Munster didn't have men like Carberry and Byrne and Omani and Conway, they put up a great fight. Yet we saw some nice rugby from Exeter. Slade was getting on the outside of their defence. Diolende was causing problems for Exeter. And on the discussion on two-legged ones, I think that is a second leg that is going to be combustible next week. I thought it was a fascinating first leg. I think it'll be a thrilling second leg.
Okay, we've got Pat Lam and Tabai Matson talking about the weekend's games and the whole structure of it. So let's listen to Pat first.
We've come up here and been guilty of trying to overplay a lot in here, and they feed off mistakes. And you would have seen when we turn ball over, that's when they're dangerous or give away penalties. But, you know, so that influence. And then also, yes, definitely, like normally in the end, you'd go for more points. But it's just about, you know, it's only, we just arrived to half time. And so that certainly, you know, is part of the psych that we just needed to make sure that we get to Ashton Gate for the second half in a good position.
I think when we were down 34-0, it was pretty humiliating. At half time, we knew there was going to be a response and we were going to score some tries in the second half. But, you know, the silver lining is we're down by 14 and we go back to the stoop and we showed a little bit of fight. For us, the first half, not taking opportunities and being well off the pace, and probably cost us in the end, didn't it? We were determined to come here and put our best foot forward, but we definitely didn't. But the beauty is we've got another 80 minutes to kind of get back into our European campaign.
The two-legged system, this two-legged system, has come in basically in a panic measure because of COVID. But does it have something? Should they keep it?
Well, it's an interesting one. I was talking about this with producer Alfie before this, because he's not a fan. I think it's de rigueur in football, so we're used to seeing it. And I can understand the thought process behind it. You know, we've come out of this tough time. There's all this chat about a cross-hemisphere club competition to try and take a bite out of another cherry. You know, we've talked about the travails of the European Cup. There's certainly a sense that it's losing something, so you can understand why they want to extend their footprint. So I can understand. I agree with Will, actually, who said earlier that it adds a little something, so long as what we've talked about is teams treat it properly. So actually we've got some incredible ties that are in the balance here that you can honestly say I don't know which way they're going to go. Personally, I don't have a massive hang up on the way it used to be, or that it was a straight knockout. And there's an interesting thing here, and I'd love to know Stuart's view on it, is whether we think that the home advantage is what it used to be, considering some of the results we've seen this weekend.
The problem is, you see, we get to the stage now, we're in knockouts and the pools are over, and you would be looking at the big teams would be having home advantage, and therefore, naturally, they'd be winning the game. It's a random mix. Yeah, Leinster were playing away. That is not right. And that is the issue. But I like a pool of 16, but you can't have a round of 16 if you're going to have six pool matches, because players, professional rugby players, do occasionally need a break. You can't keep playing. Mm. The round of 16 came in because they lost matches. They were regaining one. I don't mind the idea, but I think we'll have to lose it, because I think pools with a rigid structure for winners and runners-up is by far the fairest and best way. And if a European Cup isn't fair in the gap between pool and knockout, that's when it doesn't work. And perhaps, Steve, that's why we've got this slightly jaundiced approach, because you end up with Connacht playing at home to Leinster, and you're thinking that shouldn't be the case.
Mm. I think I agree with that as well. There are some nice ties, and I think what we might do now is about just whiz through them, and then we'll tell our viewers, listeners rather, who's going to come through. So we'll do it rapidly. Connacht take a 5-point deficit away to Leinster. So they're already behind. So any objection to us putting Leinster through there, boys?
No, absolutely not. And that match will be at the Aviva as well, I believe. So there's going to be a huge number in Dublin. I think you'd be silly to vote against Leinster there.
Sure. La Rochelle, 31-13, already up against Bordeaux. Now La Rochelle going home. So surely, again, that's one of these odd things where the French team, or one of the French teams, doesn't appear to be that interested. La Rochelle played beautifully on the weekend, so it seems to be that La Rochelle can only extend their advantage there, Stuart.
Ronan O'Gara is one of the great men of Heineken Cup years,
yes,
and he's transplanting that enthusiasm to La Rochelle. That's a big win. Bordeaux have got some good players. They've been playing pretty well in France. Game over. La Rochelle will not drop that lead at home.
Bristol, Sale, Al. I don't think anyone they won't be flooding in to watch it, I wouldn't have thought, but after Saturday. But Sale have got one chance to do something this season, and surely this is it, away in Bristol.
It is, but I could, you know, we've got the playoffs hunt to consider in the Premiership as well, and I think this is really all Bristol have got to play for this season. They're at home. Mark Evans has talked on this podcast about being a rugby city, in love with their team regardless of what's going on the pitch. So I reckon the home team will probably edge that.
Sure. To lose Ulster, we've already said, Will's already said that he fancies Ulster to finish the job. Stuart, to lose, still got some pedigrees out there. We'll have 15 men probably. Very tight.
I think that's by a mile, the game of the weekend. It's classic. Will mentioned the fact that I commentated a lot, and I've covered a huge number of grounds in the past, and Ravenhill was always one of my favourite. And Ulster are going well in Europe, even before they'd won in Clermont this season. This will take to lose to put in a European champions performance. They'll have to be a lot better than they were in last year's final or semi-final to win it. And I just get the feeling, since the Grand Slam, you know, they lost the other week with all their big guns playing 12-3 to Cast. I think whilst Racine and Montpellier keep going, Toulouse are taking their eye off the ball, and it is going to take a huge effort to win in Belfast next week. I think it would be close, because when you got Dupont playing, then he can turn a game around in the click of a finger. But Yes, I think Ulster will win, but no, I wouldn't be surprised if Toulouse pulled it back. That's the game. If you could only watch one match out of eight, there wouldn't be a question mark about what it is.
Sure. Exeter, I think the thing is with Exeter, they will be up against it massively in Munster, but Exeter know that they are superior in some key areas. So I don't know about you, Al, I got Exeter to beat Munster in Munster.
Yeah, Munster have had a hell of a lot of. Stuart mentioned it there. There's players out. They've lost a lot of players to injury. I think maybe just a bridge too far, and I think Exeter will probably squeak that one.
In the Battle of Paris, Stuart, Racine 22-9 ahead over Stade, and have really got the wool over them almost every season. I mean, Stade obviously going to battle like hell, but Racine should put them away conclusively, surely.
Racine a different class to them. Can I just briefly say, I think Munster will win. I think Thomond Park and a few players returning will make the difference. So Munster, and as you asked the question, Racine.
Okay, and the one of the key games, Montpellier-Harlequins. Montpellier, should they start well and score early, you've got a great chance, but you just sense that something's soft in there somewhere, and the Harlequins have got a great chance, Al.
Yeah, you know what? I'm gonna go against the grain here. Yep. I think Montpellier, with the renewed focus or the demands of a new focus, I don't know. Maybe something's coming from them and their monstrous pack.
Okay, fine. And I think that Leinster, I mean, Clermont may well not even bring a first team over for that. I think Leinster. But what, even if they did, I think Leicester would win. So those are our eight for the next round. Those are our talking points. And next, it's high time we spoke about the women's Six Nations over the weekend and amazing scenes at Gloucester.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Go to the Women's Six Nations and a record crowd at King's Home for the England-Wales game, and the pressure now on in the biggest club ground that we have in England for at Leicester, because the next test match is at Leicester and they have to beat something like a crowd of something like 14,000, I think, to beat the new record. So absolutely brilliant. I watched the game on replay. Brilliant atmosphere, brilliant scenes, fantastic appeal. Really, really, after the first 10 minutes, one-sided game. Al, is this the problem that they've got in the Six Nations, that eventually Wales are improved, no doubt about it, but they lost by 53 points?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you asked this, because I think it's important to put an exclamation mark against the positives that we've had. Attendances are climbing. We already know that there's a massive game at the end of the tournament. England are travelling to France. We know that that's going to be a sellout in Bayonne, and we know what to expect from that. The discourse around it has been brilliant. You know, there's been a lot more coverage, and long may that continue. But the elephant in the room is the fact that it's kind of a procession for England at the moment. And, you know, Scotland put up an incredibly brave performance against France in the second half, and they'll be incredibly proud about that. But it just shows you the distance between these top teams, England and France, and the rest, in that even if France don't turn in an amazing performance, they can do enough, more than enough. And I've heard renewed calls in Scotland, and we'll hear more and more of those about professionalism. We've got the WXV tournament is coming, so that we'll see test teams playing against each other more often, so that if you get a chance, go and check out what WXV is all about. And it's effectively, if we could think of it as an autumn cup for the women's game, and we should see over time that raise standards up whilst people also try and professionalise. But you know, you've got to walk before you can run, and it's amazing what Wales have achieved so far. Two wins, an incredible turnaround from where they've been, but they couldn't lay a glove on England, and the distance between them is vast. So take the positives from how Wales have done, but England's just look irresistible at the moment, and almost regardless of what team they put out. I mean, if you can call up Byrne and Packer and just go, off you go, they cause havoc.
Marley Packer's certainly sensational, probably playing out of his skin, and Helena Rond, fly half, as possibly filled a gap led by filled one of the gaps that they had in midfield. Emily Scarrett is back, very, very impressive indeed. Sarah Byrne playing completely off the planet, really, with the ball in hand and in the scrum.
Yeah, Steve, if I can just jump in and say something else about Scotland. The interesting thing is that they've got Italy and Ireland to come up. Ireland are actually going to lose a lot of their sevens players now. So they got their first win of the campaign against Italy, which under the new management structure, we were all very aware of the travails that the Irish structure have had, and all the gnashing of teeth and the shaking of fists about how things need to be turned around. It's an interesting thing there where they've still gone with this hybrid of 15s and 7s setups. They're going to lose quite a few talented players. Someone who was a standout at the weekend, although she had a try chopped off, was Emily Murphy-Crowe. And players like that will be lost to the Ireland setup. So there's a glimmer of an opportunity for Scotland. And to be honest, what's been the highlight of this tournament is not so much team like England running riot, but more the games like Scotland and Wales that were incredibly close. So we hope that the teams underneath that continue to put on performances like that and matches like that.
We do, but Stuart, would you agree with me that at a time when international rugby for the women needs less smashing huge victories, all they want is for Irish sevens players to be buzzing off somewhere and leaving the Six Nations behind? It's absolutely ludicrous.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I look at the women's Six Nations, and the packaging is brilliant, and no one will say a word against it. The product still leaves a bit to be desired, because England are a really good team and they're hugely improved. And I like to watch them. But when Alan says, you know, it's not about England, perhaps this tournament, it's watching Ireland and Scotland and Wales. I'll be honest, the standard when they play each other just isn't high enough. Now, that's something that very few people will say, but it's the problem of the women's game. And the most important thing that's happened to women's rugby this year was the notice that Wayne Smith was going to be playing a part trying to help the Ferns before the World Cup, because England and women's rugby need New Zealand to be strong again. Otherwise, we get into this procession, and England can win the World Cup, and it'll be back pages, and it'll be radio, and it'll be television, but the truth of it will be something different. Women's rugby needs competition to grow. It doesn't need one very good team and not much else.
I do think
that concerns me. And can I just say as well, I also I'm not certain that I agree with Alan about professionalising the women's game in any way, shape or form at the moment. I think they should be professional in the fact they train a great deal, which they do, and their skill levels are high. But if you look at where the game is at the moment professionally, in Great Britain in particular, is struggling. You know, we're about to go into, we are in economic hard times, and I don't see paying a pittance to women rugby players, and that's all that can be paid because the market's not there. I don't see how that does anything except leave them exposed when their careers come to an end.
Well, if we play the tape back, you'll see that I said that there was renewed calls for more professionalisation, and we will likely, well, there are hopes that we'll see that. I'm not saying that that's exactly what should happen, or I don't think I've given a view
when you say exactly, either way about that. Do you think there should be professionalised rugby or not?
Yeah, I don't know is the answer, Stuart. All right, I honestly don't know.
Sometimes that's the best answer, Al.
Look, the thing is, we've paid people for years, Stuart, what the game couldn't afford, and I don't think we should be a bit harsh on the girls or the ladies if we didn't do the same for them. But I have to say this, that England may not have had any tight games, but I can tell you honestly that the kids coming through 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and we've gone from my local club at Maidenhead, we've gone from having 4 to nearly 50. Absolutely love the England team. They love supporting them. They love going. They've been to all the games, and it is certainly establishing a sort of forest fire in terms of people wanting to participate. There will come a time, definitely, when even the girls will get bored with big victories. But I don't think there's much else you can do. You can't penalise England for being good, etc. And I think they should give them something to improve and something to live on while they are improving. I really do.
Now, Steve, don't get me wrong. I think that they're a fabulous team. That, you know, they're up there with a New Zealand team about 4 years ago, the best I've ever seen in women's rugby. And it's fantastic when a team can inspire as they are clearly doing. All power to them.
Okay, that's... Basically, that's the Six Nations carries on this week. We're now going to move on to God or Goddess of the Week. We'll go with you first, Al. Let's have your contender, please.
Yep, I considered giving what you could call an albatross or a black cat or the underside of the ladder award to Kevin Williams, who, if you get a chance, go and watch the clip of him hitting the post, trying to kick the ball out, the ball staying in field in Canada, scoring at the death, incredible. But in the end, I had to go for the Mark Evans patented Devil of the Week for Tolu Latu. Just a crazy number of cards this season, 6 yellow, got second red at the weekend for taking a player out in the air against Racing, and I don't think there's anything more damning to say about Latu than his own coach Gonzalo Quesada, who said after the match, I quote, "The fault should be between Latu and the coaches. He's been doing the same thing for weeks, so it's also our fault for putting him on the pitch." I think that's incredibly damning, a coach regretting playing a player. So Latu head and shoulders above anyone else for Devil of the Week.
That's pretty good. Well, you can go God or Goddess or Devil, Stuart.
Just very briefly there, that comment was absolutely right. When you see these head-on-head tackles, coaches should be saying, why aren't we coaching this out of the game? I'm thinking of the Leicester red card. Hmm. Coaches have got to say, we're responsible for this as well. A culture of our game has to act. But anyway, that's all a bit serious and dull. My God of the Week, it has to be an Ulster player. Winning and to lose is a gigantic achievement against DuPont and half the Grand Slam team. And to score a hat-trick, Robert Balakou, the young winger, has to be the God of the Week, towering from Olympus over everyone else.
Blimey, Olympus, okay. So we got a devil and a god. Mine's going to be a god. I just think that Zach Mercer was forced out, really, by his own ambition, but by Eddie Jones, because he didn't want to stay. Well, probably didn't want to stay in the Bath team. He wasn't playing very well, and couldn't see anything in the future with Eddie Jones. I would have kept him and fought to keep him. You never know what things are going to be like when you go abroad, but it was so lovely to see him play so well for Montpellier. It'd be nice to see him at Harlequins again, do the same, put himself back in contention. He's still young enough to come again on the England scene, and for me, he is a better player than an awful lot of the contenders that England have been contending with for their number 8 position. So that's Zach Mercer. I don't think we can have an overall winner there, but we have got one devil. I think Balakum is a great god. So there we go. That's the God or Goddess of the Week done. It's also very apposite that we mention someone who the game lost this week, Al.
Yeah, I just wanted to take this opportunity to say a few words about Tom Smith. You're right, rugby's lost a true great of the game, and I'm sure you fellas can talk an awful lot about what it was like to watch him as he was coming through. Certainly this is a big deal for someone like myself, who was a young loosehead coming through in Dundee, where Tom Smith first cut his teeth when he was playing for Dundee High School FPs. And I can tell you that the guy leaves a big footprint, in fact, a footprint big enough for 10 quiet, menacing blokes. I just wanted to share a couple stories. I've been speaking to some people about Tom and what he meant to everyone, and a few stories about where he's come from. There's an awful lot that's been made about what a quiet force he was. When he was first coming through Dundee, there's an awful lot of stories about what kind of player he was. This is a guy who played number 8 as well as in the front row at age grade level. There's an apocryphal story, but I suppose legends probably deserve legends of themselves, about when he was playing a youth international match. The coach shouted from the touchline, "You're wearing number 1 on your jersey, not number 10. But that's kind of fitting, because he was a guy that had a skill set that set him apart from everyone else. And when he grew into the game, he really stood out. People will talk about his scrummaging prowess, and you know, Stuart, I'm sure, could wax lyrical about that. But also just what he brought around the park, it was something different. And it's telling that a guy could traverse the turning of the mat of the game to professionalism into running into 2009 for the Saints, just turning in performance after performance, a legend for Scotland and for the British and Irish Lions. You listen to some of the stories that other people have shared about him, I've seen over the last week. Chris Custer talking about how terrified he was to get a whisper in the ear after hitting a bag too boisterously in his first Scotland camp. I heard a sponsor talking about how he got a quiet word in his ear about making Tom pose in a few silly positions with certain sponsors' accoutrement, and deciding never to ask him to do that again. There was a story I saw from Gordon Bullock, who was called up late to the Lions tour, and then when he came on in the first test, the heat of battle, and Tom Smith just turns to him and says something along the lines of "same as usual," and just knocked in. This is a guy who, everyone will tell you, didn't have much to say, but when he did, it really mattered. He talked with his performances on the pitch. A lovely bloke. And there was one last story I wanted to share. And this comes from my father, who was lucky enough to play a coach and play with Tommy, who said that one of the last times he spoke to him face to face, he bumped into him in the 2017 Lions tour. We were all there, and it was after the first test in Auckland. And my father asked him, "Were you at the Eden Park to watch the match?" And he said, "No, actually, I was at Dan Carter's house to watch the game." And he actually made a request that I speak to him in French the whole time, so that he could brush up on the language. But also, I suspect, because he didn't want to have to talk to anyone else when he could be talking to a bona fide legend about rugby. So just wanted to share a little bit about Tom. And, you know, we wish all the best to his young family, taken away from us too soon. But I can guarantee he's a man that will never be forgotten.
OK, that's it for this week. I think we've turned over every dusty corner of the game and a few more. Next week, we'll be reflecting on the second legs of the Champions Cup games. Thank you to Stuart. Thank you to Big Al, and thanks for our producer. And back next week.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea, with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.